right, so we are on Job lesson 6, and we're going to talk about self-righteousness today. I do want to say, and perhaps this doesn't need to be on tape, but I just want to tell you how excited I am when I go into your groups, how much more in-depth you're getting with your answers and coming up with literally where the lesson will go. I mean, all of you, I heard bits and pieces of the lesson, and I thought, I am so impressed that you're really getting the hang of actually digging deep into asking questions of the text and where are we going from that. I loved, the very last thing I heard was somebody said, it's interesting how our view of Job has changed now. At the beginning, we're saying, poor Job, and now we're saying, Job, what are you doing? Right? Which is exactly where the lesson is going. So, great job. Love to hear that you're doing much more in-depth stuff. So when you hear pieces of what you've already talked about in here, don't be surprised. Really quick, I want to just do a...
such a great teacher.
Really, I don't think so. Really, the thanks, Anna.
I'm trying not to be self-righteous.
No, the practice of conversing with one another and actually like having space to actually think through these things a little bit deeper, I think is really helpful. When all you do is sit in a lecture, you won't go there yourself. But when you have to converse with one another, you do. And definitely there's a huge change from session one to now. So... really, guys, I really love that you've really embraced that.
I think it helps clarify some things, too, because
it does, doesn't
you don't
it?
Bring stuff out
right.
To disturb everybody.
Right, exactly.
I
can yeah.
Yep,
exactly. So,
small group.
Good job. Real quick, I want to just review how we did last week. I'll review a little bit more on the wisdom from last week, and then we'll get into it. So, what we've learned from... actually, originally, I was going to just make this blank. I was going to say... what we've learned from Genesis is this and this. So next week, if you see your review and it says what we learned from Genesis and there's a blank there or maybe like a nice blank line, get ready for it. So you'll know that we'll probably be doing that. So what we learned from Genesis, without looking at your paper, see if you can do that. What did we learn from Genesis about God?
God
is for us. What did we learn from the idea that Job is a construct? Yes. God wants us to examine our thinking. Remember, there's always about God. So God wants us to examine our thinking. He thinks it's important enough that he actually has someone write a whole book about thinking. What we learned about from examining theology.
Can't be defined by system.
Okay, stop looking, Karen.
Everybody else does.
I'm just trying to see how much you can remember from that. So examining systems, we realized that God can't, or examining theology, we realized God can't be defined by systems. What are the two systems?
RP.
Right. Great symbiosis, which is what the world thinks, and RP is what Israel thought and what the church thinks. So those are the two systems. What we found about God by examining hope. What did we learn about God from examining hope?
We all have to look. Trust.
The word trust.
God cannot be evaluated by our picture.
Right. God can't be evaluated by our picture of what God is, right? So remember we talked about what we hope in. And usually we hope that God is love. Unless, of course, somebody does something horrible to us. And then we hope that God is...
Just,
right? So that kind of thing. We have to be careful to not evaluate God by our pictures of him. What we learn from examining power. This is my favorite lesson. This is about Rahab. God's power is...
Like the chaos.
Yes, wisdom is about, right? God's power is directed purposefully by wisdom, right? So he uses his wisdom so that his power is restrained for a very specific purpose. And his, what is God's purpose? Always, always, always?
Connection.
Connection. To make that Sabbath space where man and God can relate rightly. We talked a lot about that in the last couple of years. What we learned about examining wisdom, and obviously this was last week, we learned that God knows what he's doing. Right? God does know what he's doing. Wisdom emanates from him. And wisdom can only be received. I can't go and find it. I can't manufacture it for myself. I can't take it as if it's something I can own. It's not a commodity. And we can only participate in his wisdom through recognizing him as wise. So recognizing him as wise is the same thing as saying, fear the Lord, fear Adonai. So not fear God. And not fear Yahweh, but fear Adonai, Lord. I'm submissive. I know that he's wise, and I'm not. And that's the only way I can participate in it. Which means I submit to his wisdom by turning away from independence, by turning away from thinking that I can come up with great ideas on my own, that I have this inward mindset idea that it's all about me, it's all about my circumstances. And I can figure it out. I can make life for myself. Also, not expecting our circumstances to make sense all the time. They're just not. And Scripture never says, well, if you just believe the right thing, everything will make sense. It actually doesn't say that. It just says trust, right? Also, the part of about learning to be submissive means allowing those rough edges that come, whether it's from suffering, from pain, or suffering from discomfort or hard circumstances, letting those rough edges be. Not trying to sand those down, but letting those rough edges be places where God can actually connect his life with yours. And we're going to actually see more of that today. Because the battle is not against pain, and it's not against suffering. It's against static living. It's against living without growing, without actually allowing more of his life to grow into mine. And we tend to think that we're battling suffering, right? We feel like we're doing well if things are going well. And I can figure this out. I can cope with this so that my rough edges aren't rough anymore. We tend to think that the more spiritual you are, the better your life is, which is actually the opposite, right? I've been reading lots of Eugene Peterson's stuff because he's in hospice. Has he?
He died.
He did pass away.
Aww.
Eugene Peterson, who is like probably the theologian of our century. If you ever want to read a really, 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 really good book, read his Eat These Words.
What?
Eat These Words by Eugene Peterson. I've been reading lots of his stuff. He goes over this kind of stuff over and over again about it's not against suffering. It's not against that. It's this static living, this idea of you looking good, that your life looks good. And the more spiritual you are, the more close you get into God's life, the less nice you'll look, the less nicely edged life you'll have. Because it means that you're open on all ends of your life to allow God's life to flow in you. So letting go of those ideas of reputation, which we have syncretized from the world's ideas, that is not the church's ideas. All right, so that's kind of a review of where we've been. So today we talk about Elihu, and it's only Elihu's speeches, and we are going to see Elihu actually plays the role of the defense attorney for God. So remember, we're still talking about trial. The first trial is over. The second trial has begun, supposedly. Job wants this hearing. And so Elihu steps in to say, I'm going to defend God here. No one's defending God. No one has defended God in the first section, right, in the first trial. Job has defended himself. The friends have defended the RP. But remember, there's three corners of this triangle. There's the RP, there's man's righteousness or Job's righteousness, and then there's God's justice. So that's what Elihu is going to do. He's going to defend God. But we have to remember, just because Elihu speaks on God's defense doesn't mean that his words are all right. We still need to examine some of them. And it's great. I loved sitting 5 minutes into a group. The first thing they said was, so Elihu has a lot of great things to say about God, and what he says about God are correct, but he doesn't come to the right conclusion. So I heard that and I thought, my job is done. This is great. So we do have to examine his words. Today, even today we do this, right? We find somebody who says they're speaking for God, they're a Christian, and we think, oh great, I don't have to examine it, I just can take that. And that's not true. The pastor that I grew up under, who baptized me, reminded us every single Sunday. He would open the word and he would say, do not take what I say for granted. Do not take that as truth. Examine it for yourself. He said that from day one. Examine it, examine it, examine it. Look into scripture and don't assume that. So we need to do that with Elihu's words as well. So let's get into Elihu. Elihu, did you do a word study on it?
Yeah.
What did you find it means?
My God is he. She knows. Now, it wasn't quite under, I think
she
it
knows.
Was the mom, because it said Elihu was a baby name. And so I was thinking it was the mom who was carrying the baby. She knows.
Never heard that.
The Lord perfectly understand the Lord is my God.
Yeah, so he is my God. That's what it means. I mean, just in Hebrew, if that's what you were going
right.
to, that's what it means. He is my God.
I read somewhere, too, that it's the same name as Elijah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so lots of the names in the Old Testament, you'll notice, are similar to different ones. Like Joshua is the same name as Jesus in the New Testament. Yeshua. So lots of different things like that. Especially in the Old Testament, names are important. We've not talked about the names of the others. I will tell you the name of Job. Do you know what the name of Job means?
I didn't know.
It means hated.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It means hated, right? Why would they hate Job?
Because he had all the, in the beginning, he was righteous and he had all the blessings.
Oh, you think that's why? I think it's because he messed up the order, right? He's challenging, he's saying the RP doesn't work by what's going on. They hate that, right? We all hate that when our world is messed up. When I talked about Job being a construct, how many of you hated that? So I know lots of you did because you walked away going, I don't like that. That can't be true. So interesting. So Elihu means he is my God, which gives you an idea of what his role is. His role is to defend God against Job's indictment, right? And Job has said he is unjust. God is not good. God doesn't know what he's doing. And so Elihu feels like he must stand up. And I really love the poetry that Elihu uses about happening. So somebody keeps on saying things against God, against God, against God, and you can feel the fire in his heart. Like, I can't let this go on any longer, even though in A&E culture, he has no right to be speaking. So he is driven by this righteous anger. God is not being accurately seen through Job's actions. And so that really upsets him. And so he's angry against Job for regarding his own righteousness over God's righteousness. But he's also angry with the friends. Did you catch that? He is angry with the friends because they have condemned Job without actually having finding fault. And because of that, they have not brought Job any closer to being able to represent God well, be able to say, God, I'm sorry, be submissive to Job and to God. So they failed, and he hates that they failed, mainly because it hasn't brought Job back to where he needs to be. So he's genuinely concerned about Job, but he's even more concerned about whom?
Everybody.
God. He's mostly concerned about God's reputation. That's what's driving Elihu. That's why it is righteous anger. So what he intends to do, he intends to hold Job accountable to God. Where Job is trying to hold God accountable to himself, Elihu wants to turn it around. No, Job, you are accountable to God. And he will. His intention is also to defend then that third piece of the triangle. Remember the triangle, RP, Job's righteousness, and God's justice. And he's going to defend God's justice. So we'll have this whole picture, and then we'll be able to determine, is the RP the way that God runs the world? And of course, as we've already alluded to, Elihu shows us that the RP doesn't run the world. He doesn't think that. He thinks it still does, but that's what his job is going to be do. So the rhetorical purpose of his role is twofold, and this is where that last comment exactly brings. The first purpose of his role in Job is to help us, the reader, whether it's Israel, first readers, or us now, is to help us get an honest view of Job. So we start at the beginning, and you're supposed to. You're supposed to feel like, oh, I know how Job feels. I've been through this. I get it. Poor Job, you know. It is unfair. It is unfair. Until you get to this point, and Elihu kind of shows him, well, this is really what Job's going, what's happening with Job, where Job has gone to from the beginning to here. So that we get an honest picture of Job, which is important because most of the times when you hear sermons or you hear things about Job, it's always, the book of Job is so often used as Job as a model, right? Job as a model of patience. Would you use Job as a model of patience right now? Mm-hmm. Mm-mm, see? If you know well enough, you wouldn't. And yet, I hear sermon after sermon about that. We use the term, the patience of Job.
Yeah.
That's not what it's about. It's not about Job being a model. It's about Job showing us, being a mirror, right? Showing us this is where we're at. How can we get that back on track? So Elihu's speeches will begin to reveal the lack in Job's character. So there's been a lot good about Job, but there's a lack in Job's character that we'll see very clearly now. The friends tried to find a lack in Job's motivation, which is the first thing. Can there be disinterested righteousness? Can there be non-transactional righteousness? Yes. Job really wants relationship. He doesn't want other things from the relationship. He wants relationship. Yep, that's very true. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a lack in his character, and that's what we're going to see. And that's important for us too, right? Because we tend to think, well, if I have a relationship with God, everything's good. But when you think about that, if you're married or if you know people who are married and you say, well, as long as they're married, things are good. Okay, yeah, and as soon as, yeah, every one of us that are married smile and go, oh, yeah. No, not true, right? You got to build through that. You got to learn each other. And it doesn't mean that, you know, there's like, oh, there's this light bulb that goes on. Oh, I got it. Now everything is good. As long as I'm married and I got that one point, we got it. Right? It's not true. So we have to be careful. So many times because we present the gospel as transactional, if you believe in Jesus, you get to go to heaven. One of the problems with that is that means that, oh, as long as I have this relationship with God where I believed Jesus, now I have what I need and that's all I need, right? Now I have this person I get to talk to and tell them what to do. Well, when we start examining it, that is what we do, right? So there's a problem with transactional ideas of the gospel, and one of them is we tend to think as long as I have a relationship, things are good and I don't have to worry about it. Rather than what kind of relationship do I have, and that relationship needs to be built up, right? So that's kind of part of what we see with happening with Job. The other rhetorical purpose of his role is to begin to see that the RP is not going to hold up as a foundational principle for how God runs the world. And we're going to be able to see that the RP isn't consistent. And you can't have a system that's not consistent run the world, because the minute doesn't work, the world collapses. Right? The minute, let's say we're using gravity as our premise, and the minute gravity doesn't work, everything collapses, right? So you're going to begin to see, if it's not consistent, it cannot be the system that runs the world. Otherwise, the world would collapse. So that's another purpose of Elihu's role. When we get into chapter 32, we'll notice that Elihu starts out with the basis for his authority. And he needs to do this because he is a young man talking to the old sages. So, of course, in years past, you were wise if you were old, if you were an elder. And so for someone young to... Now, don't picture someone who's 20. This Elihu is probably middle age, but still in that setting, he would still have been recognized as a little whippersnapper, right? Who do you think you are? And so he needs to establish his authority. So his authority, he says, is established from knowing, first of all, where wisdom comes from. And what he does is he reaffirms what has been told by the narrator in 28, right? Mm-hmm. That wisdom comes from God alone, and only with connection with God can you have wisdom. It has nothing to do with age. That's pretty profound for him to say that in that community, for him to be able to say, hey, it's not about being old, it's about being connected. Mm-hmm. So he says, the Israelite thought, so I'm going to give you just a little background of how Israel would have thought about how you participate in that wisdom. We talk about you need to participate in the wisdom by being connected to God. And partially the way they figured that out was it wasn't by a choice so much as how God made us. So remember, everything that you learn in Job is foundational to build on more, right? It isn't the end of what we know, but it's the beginning. So this is how they thought about the human being. The human being, the human's spirit, is on loan from God. So they didn't consider the human being three parts, right? Well, how do we consider the human being? Soul, mind, right? Body, mind, and spirit, however you want to say that. Body, soul, spirit. Yeah. That actually comes out of the Greek philosophers. So that's where that comes from. But they began to think that humanity is a soul. So it's nephesh. It's where we get in Genesis 1, it talks about, and Adam became a soul. See, flesh is a bad translation because it actually means soul. So Adam became a nephesh, a soul. So humanity is a soul, which ceases when one dies. Now, remember that we talked about what they thought happened after death. Where did one go?
Sheol.
And now, if that's true, then how can they say that you cease to exist when you die? That sounds like a contradiction to us, right?
Cease to exist here. It's all about here.
Like your body?
So existence for them, now we have to go all the way back to Genesis 1, existence for them means you have a function, right? It's mm-hmm. all functional ontology. We consider existence being material ontology, right? Like if I have a body, I exist. Or if I have something of myself, I exist. That's not how they saw existence. Existence was if you have a function. That's existence. So to die and then to go to Sheol is a place of non-functionality. There's no function for you in Sheol, which means you don't exist. That sounds crazy to us, but remember they're functionally ontological thinking, not material like we are. We need to think about how that is. So a human is a soul, and that ceases to exist. You cease to exist when you die. A human has a body. So the human isn't the body. We don't actually think that either, although we kind of treat it like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we treat our body like that. Well, as long as my body's working well. But a human has a body, which was made by God, and it will return to dust when you die. So it's a temporary thing. A human has a spirit. And this is where it's interesting. The spirit is given by God as a portion of his own spirit, and it will return to God upon death. So that's how they thought about what happens with the spirit.
And they is the A&E?
This is Israel.
Israel.
This would be Israel, yeah. The A&E is a little bit like that, just a little more. I'm not quite sure exactly what they feel about that spirit part.
So, Jill, yeah. When you were saying that Israel believed when you die, you cease to exist.
Yes. Yes. Remember, again, Job is forming a foundation for what God will reveal in the future, right? So there's a foundation to that. In Zechariah, it talks about God placing his spirit in a human being. That spirit then becomes the person's spirit until death. In other words, the spirit is on loan. It's not yours to keep. That's how they felt about it. And it was God's spirit put in you, because that's what Genesis 2 says, right? That God breathed his spirit, his ruach, into man, and man became nefesh, a soul, a human being. The spirit's purpose is to enliven, to energize. It's almost like being given food so that you can do something. And to enliven and be energized is what the spirit did within man, or what it does in man. So that's how they're thinking. Which again, you can understand why Sheol is one of these, I will cease to exist, so there will not be relationship in Sheol, right? Which is why Job is so adamant that he get vindicated now so that his relationship can be restored, because that's the only place he'll have relationship. He won't have it in Sheol. The interesting thing is that becomes then the basis for then when we begin to go into the New Testament and into Acts, when we recognize the Holy Spirit coming. And the Holy Spirit coming into us is ours to keep, right? It becomes ours and never leaves us. It doesn't return to God. It means that we return to God, right? So there's a lot of going on here of just laying the foundation of what's going to happen in the New Testament. And of course, in Acts, when the Holy Spirit comes, it's not just God's Spirit is now your spirit. But it's also it does more than just energize you. It actually gives you an expression of God's character. So in Acts, sometimes we look at that Acts thing and we think, oh, isn't that great? We get the Holy Spirit. But unless you know the background, you don't recognize how much they would have gone, are you kidding? I get to keep this and I get to express God's character. That was never a part of their idea of that. So all these little, there's lots of it. I've not even covered half of it, of these little pieces that are laying a foundation for us to be able to understand what happens in the New Testament and to appreciate it more. So I still am very upset that Andy Stanley would be all over this idea of, we don't have to worry about what's in the Old Testament. He's very much about separating that. That, by the way, is a heresy. The church really fought that. So it's unfortunate that he's talking about that. It is important that we know the Old Testament, because it gives us this basis for what happens in the New. It's a continuation of the story. But also it gives us the appreciation for what we have. When we start with the New, we have very little appreciation for what's going on. We have very little appreciation.
So cool to be able to teach the Bible to, like, the beginning, like when you're a little kid, you're a 2-year-old, this is the story, and then as you are an adult, then you're revealed.
Yes.
What was revealed
exactly? Yes.
Like,
yes.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. No. Exactly. And that's really what God is doing. He's teaching Israel as a little kid, and as they're growing, they get to add more and more and more. And it's really important. The kind of setup that he does for us so that we walk into the New Testament with a lot more background. So, Elihu's strategy. This is what he's going to do. First of all, he says he's compelled to speak on the behalf of God. And this is where he just talks about, he's so full, it just is exploding out of him. I don't know, Lisa, you said you've been reading it through the Message. Do you remember how it used it in the Message? I think the Message is a good way to kind of understand it a little better, but first go to the poetry, because the poetry is amazing. The poetry, the way that each of these speakers speaks in the poetry. Remember I told you poetry, things with lots of metaphors, allow our brain to actually access it as if we're experiencing it. Mm-hmm. So the message is great for us to perhaps understand it better, but it will not give our brain the same experience as if we're experiencing for ourselves. So read it first in the poetry that it was originally given to you. He says that, now notice, Elihu is the first one to bring up a name that hasn't been used for God before. What does he use?
The maker.
The maker, yes. My maker. He uses maker at least four times. And that's very essential for who Elihu is and what he's trying to do. He says that the maker would unmake him if he misused the wisdom he was given through the spirit that God breathed into him. If he used it to flatter Job in order to get Job to be under the RP. He said, that would be a misuse of the wisdom that God had given me. And so I have to be submissive to my maker. Really what he's saying is exactly, chapter 28 is, I fear the Lord. I fear God as Adonai. He is the one who's wise, and I have to be under him. And so he's telling you not only where his authority comes from, but his understanding of how to look at the world is to look under God's what God has revealed rather than himself. And we see then that Elihu is connected to God. His wisdom of participating in God is that submissiveness to God being wise and it being his wisdom that he's going to look on and participate in. I think the next part is really interesting. In 33:1-7, he actually does something none of the other wise guys have done. And he starts to name worth in Job. What was the first thing the other guys did to him?
Condemn him,
right? Job, you're an idiot. What are you doing? What happens when the first thing somebody does come up to you and say, Teresa, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. What's the first thing you would do, Teresa?
You're defensive.
You're defensive. Yeah. Absolutely. That's the first thing that comes up, right? And that's what we've talked about even in our conversation. We need to be able to converse and have different opinions. How do we do that? We don't first go right to the thing, judge or anything. The first thing we do is we use each other's name. Do you believe out through this whole thing, Elihu was the first one to use Job's name? He calls Job, three or four times, he says, Job. None of the other friends have ever used Job's name. And so when you say, yeah, it's uncomfortable in our conversations to use each other, this is the one thing I didn't see happen. I didn't see anyone using anyone's name today.
Good.
I'm sure you did. I just wasn't there. It's a reminder that it's a helpful way to begin a conversation, right? To use somebody's name. So we have Elihu doing that. He uses Job's name. Of course, naming worth. But he also then says, hey, Job, you don't need to be afraid of me because you and I are the same. And I actually, this is the poetry I love. How does he say we're the same? Do you remember?
I belong to God like you. I too have been formed out of clay.
Is that how it says in the NAS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's two versions of NAS, and I always go back to my Bible. So the original says, we've been pinched from the same clay.
Oh.
And I love that idea of, like, we're pinched. Yeah. Like, we're both made out of the same clay. So that he says, there's no reason for you to be, like, I'm not better than you. But what have the three friends done? They immediately come in saying, remember they even conspired together before they got to Job, right? We're going to show them. We've got the wisdom here. He needs to listen to us. And they say over and over again, you know, we're the wise men. Who do you think you are? And Elihu's saying, you know what? We're both pinched from the same clay. We're on equal. You don't have to be afraid of me. So again, he reminds Job of his worth. That we're in this together. I'm not trying. It's a clear saying. It's not an us and them situation. And that's what the friends have done. So we see underneath this exactly what we've been talking about all along. Is What does an outward mindset look like? It values the other. It tells the other you are valuable by using name, by saying we're the same. And then he says he really wants to help them. He wants to be able to justify Job. So the others don't ever say that. They just say, you are messing up our order. Get what you need to do and come and do it, because you're messing up our order. Elihu doesn't say that. He's definitely wanting to defend God, but he's also bringing Job in. Do you see this idea of he wants to bring Job into this? And you'll get that even more when we talk through what he's doing. What he's trying to do here, although we never hear Job's thoughts about what Elihu says. Notice Job doesn't have a response to Elihu. We don't get to see that, but what we do understand because of what comes next is that Elihu has prepared the ground for Job to be able to listen to God. Up until this time, the friends and Job have been paying their attention on Job. What are you doing, Job? What's going on with you, Job? How are you messing things up, Job? How can you get things back together, Job? And Elihu, actually, because of naming Job's worth, is able to then bring his attention back to God. And because of the groundwork that he does, Job doesn't need to respond because now he's ready to listen to God. So the way, remember, and you always have to remember this, why does God want us to examine our thoughts about him? Because our thoughts about God will inform how we think about others, mm-hmm. and then how we act toward others, and how we act toward our circumstances. And that's what you're beginning to see with Elihu. Elihu is thinking about God in the right ways, and therefore thinking about Job in the right ways. He's not coming to Job as if I've got the answers, you don't, and you're stupid. He's saying, hey, we're in this together, you know, maybe I can help. So we have this laying the groundwork for Job to actually turn his attention from himself and his own circumstances to God. So you see that Elihu makes this swing for Job to go into the next chapters. From 8 to 11 and 33, Elihu does a good job of summarizing Job's position. Job has said, and this is what he says, Job, and this, again, this is what happens, right, in our groups. It's great for someone to either say, now, if I'm understanding correctly, this is what you've said. And or toward the end, we summarize, right? And that summarization is great because then you can see, oh, this is what we've said. This is what Elihu's saying. So, Job, you've said this. You've said you're suffering unfairly. And because of that, God cannot possibly be good or know what he's doing. And basically, it's like, right, Job, is that what you meant? Yep. Does a good job of that. And then he goes into warning Job. So look at how long it's taken him to get to that point, which is great, right? Because he's set the boundary for Job to listen, not only to him, but more importantly, to get his attention back on God. And so he warns him, Job, God is greater than man. God is greater than man. You are being presumptuous to think you can understand God and what God is doing. And I heard that in the groups as well. We need to understand that we can't understand everything that God is doing. So he'll name just a few things for Job to think about. He says, God is not inconsistent. You think he's inconsistent, the way that he is applying justice. But just because you haven't been told what he's doing doesn't mean that you know what he's doing. So just take your papers for a minute and make them into, you know, one of these. Nice and narrow. And then I want you to look through that. Don't move your head around. Just look through that and tell me what's going on in the room. That's all you know and that's all you see, right? And that's what Elihu is trying to say is, you have a very small perspective. This is all you see. There's so much more going around you. So much more that is complicated.
Tunnel vision.
Which we all have, right? We all have one perspective. This is what we see. And hopefully, one of my purposes is to make that tunnel vision maybe just a little bit bigger. Take down some of those walls so that we get to see more. But we're never going to see it all, right? We don't stand where God stands. So this is what he tells Job. God is not inconsistent. Just because life doesn't make sense to you doesn't mean it doesn't make sense. You just don't understand everything that's going on. And therefore, God is just. You just don't see how he is just. He also says God is not silent. You're just not listening in the right places. So he says God speaks in a couple ways. And he names two. He doesn't mean to say these are the only ways to speak. But here's two ways. He says God speaks in dreams. Specifically nightmares. Nightmares that would warn others. That would warn you that you are going the wrong way. It's so interesting that this would come up, because this last week I had a nightmare. We were at a dinner party, and I'm somebody I don't really like to try new stuff, and they had all these exotic things there, and I just went for it. I thought, I'm going to just take everything. I shook two of this. This is going to sound weird. These tiny little pigs. Little tiny pigs that were like fried, but not with a coating, that you could see that they were little pigs.
Like your little pig in the front room.
Yeah, I know, a little pig there. I have my little pig over here. But I ate the whole thing like that.
God.
And somebody said, what are you doing? Your bones and everything. I said, oh, don't worry, it's just an embryo. It's just that cartilage. And when I said that to the person, I realized, what am I doing? It was a nightmare to me. Like, even now, I think, that's so gross. And I had, because we're studying this, I thought, God, are you warning me? Am I going somewhere I shouldn't be going? So I'm still kind of working through that.
Or did you just eat something weird?
Well, I couldn't figure it out. But so my background is in psychology, and it was a pastor who was my advisor, and we actually had to do dream analogies, and we had to learn how to wake ourselves up and write down our dreams, and so kind of worked through some of that. Anyway, Elihu says, God does speak sometimes through dreams, through nightmares. And in, particularly in our culture, we think that's a little weird, right? That's kind of mysticism, and we're not quite sure about that. I will tell you, in Syria, where both my kids live, both of them experienced, not dreams themselves, but they both attended separately, different years, by themselves. They attended a baptism of a Muslim man who had been called by Jesus to come to him in a dream. You hear that a lot,
yes,
in other countries, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in other countries. So does God speak through dreams? Absolutely, he does speak through dreams. So Elihu's just saying, Job, you think that God needs to speak to you one way, but God speaks many ways. He says also sometimes God speaks in pain, right? He speaks through physical pain to get your attention, to return to him. And that's all Elihu is trying to do, is get Job to have his attention not on his circumstances, but on God. Trying to get him that. And he says, therefore, sometimes God speaks to be instructive or constructive, not to punish. So he says, you're looking at your suffering wrong. Your suffering perhaps is instructive. Your suffering perhaps is constructive to get you to pay attention to God. That's what Elihu is saying. So he says, Job, you're not paying attention. Just because you're not tracking with what God is doing, you're in danger of being dissatisfied and then depressed. And because of that, you're in danger of then reaching out for different ways of getting what you want rather than turning your attention toward God. And we'll talk about that in self-righteousness. So he's warning Job, and he's warning him not as this, you are such an idiot, Job. Job, you got to be careful what's happening here. Don't you understand that you're slipping down this road that can be very slippery? You're getting to a place where God is trying to warn you. Don't go there. So he says, what you need is a mediator to help you out. And he says, this mediator, remember Job has wanted a mediator, right? But what kind of mediator does Job want?
Someone to defend him,
to vindicate him, to say to God, Job is righteous, Job is right, you're wrong. But Elihu says, you do need a mediator, but not that kind of mediator. You need a mediator who's a diplomat, someone who can sit in the middle and go, here, Job, this is what you're saying. This is what God's saying. Let's see how we can come together, bringing two parties together rather than defending you, Job. And that mediator then will say to you, Job, this is what's right, Job. And then it will, that mediator will intercede with God to be gracious, to spare Job's life. So he's talking about a mediator that can bring both sides together. And then he says that this mediator also will provide a ransom. Now, of course, as you read this, of course, what are you thinking? You're thinking Jesus right away, right? He's not there yet, but he's definitely setting a foundation, right? Because actually Elihu is offering himself as that mediator. And when he talks about a ransom, he's actually talking about a portion of his wisdom that could actually provide a reasoning that would actually allow both sides to come together. Now, that is a great foundation for then when we get into the New Testament. But remember again, it's not there yet. So it's not fully blown. It's not exactly what Jesus does here. So what he's trying to do then is to bring Job out of that inward mindset, right? I'm going to be a mediator to help you out of that inward mindset. And I'm going to be that mediator for you. I can give you reasoning that would allow you to make progress toward an outward mindset, to make progress toward getting your attention back to God. And then I can also provide that asking God to be gracious to you. And he says then, if you allow me to do this, this is what will happen. You'll be restored, but you'll also be reconciled. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that Elihu kind of brings in, you're going to be restored, according to the RP, but you'll also have your relationship reconciled. That will happen, and this is how it will happen. God will restore your health, and you will be reconciled with God as you, Job, first publicly confess that you've done wrong. And, see, Elihu, remember, is more concerned about God's reputation than anything else. So there has to be an and to it. It's not just that you confess you're wrong, but also that you proclaim God's grace, that you actually praise God publicly, because that will restore God's reputation to the world as being just and good. So Elihu feels if Job does this, then there will be this reconciliation, right? Because you will no longer be saying that God is not good nor unjust. Notice that Elihu is concerned about God's reputation. The friends have never cared about God's reputation once. They only care about the RP getting back, right? So I feel good, like I know how the world works. They're concerned more about the RP's reputation for working. Elihu is concerned about God's reputation being brought back to where it needs to be brought back to, and that God is just. But in that, we recognize also that Elihu is still fighting for the RP. Mm-hmm. He still wants that to work. He just says, we've got to start with God up there. So, again, Elihu is right as far as he's talking about who God is, but wrong as far as how the world works, how God actually runs the world. So, and we'll look at that, too, as we look at self-righteousness. So as we get into chapter 34, he's going to really expound on self-righteousness and where Job is and why that's a problem and where he needs to go from here. So he states outright many times from 32 all the way through the end of his speech at 37 that Job is self-righteous, right? You've seen that, right? Right at 32 he says Job is righteous in his own eyes, and then it goes on. And if you were doing any portion of an observation worksheet and trying to find the words that were repeated over and over again, self-righteous in some form was the key. It was over and over and over again. We found it in many places. He's righteous in his own eyes, justifies himself, pride several times, empty, but empty is actually the word vanity or vain, magnifying himself, and the very last verse of his speech is, He does not, God does not regard any who are wise of heart. And that wise of heart is actually the word conceit. Who are conceited.
What?
Conceit. Who are conceited. Who think
like
that.
Like your own wisdom. Like
yes.
You're getting it yourself. Not,
yes, exactly. So when we talk about self-righteousness, it's always interesting because we tend to, because we know the word so well, we tend to go back to behavior ideas. It's still relationship ideas. It's pride within relationship. And this is really a big deal. And this, I think, for me, this really helped scoop out for me, where do I have pride in relationship with God? It, oftentimes I have to look at, well, what does my relationship with others look like? Do I have pride in my relationship with others? Because remember, how we treat others comes from the idea of how we think of God. So sometimes that will help you understand where your self-righteousness is. So self-righteousness sees relationships as proportional. In other words, you see yourself as the center of relationship. In other words, you have either initiated the relationship or sustained the relationship more than someone else has. And this is what Job thinks of himself, right? He thinks, basically, at this point, you know, I want relationship, but hey, you know, I'm the one who listened to you, God. I'm the one who, because I listened to you and valued that, that I have obeyed you. And because of that, I wanted to have more relationship with you. He's beginning to think that he's the one who's initiated the relationship. And we go, oh, well, we don't think that. Except that so many times we think this and we don't realize how important our words are. We say, because I have believed in God, he has entered relationship with me. Mm-hmm. That's backwards.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this is where it becomes a little tricky, right? We think that there is no relationship until I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Not true. He has entered a relationship with Job way before Job ever listened to him. And the same with us. It's that believing and receiving that relationship, right? So when we think about ourselves as the center of relationship, we have to think about, do I think that because I believed, now I'm in relationship? Or because God gave me relationship, I can believe? It sounds subtle. It is not. It is a huge, big deal. Job and all self-righteousness does this. Self-righteousness believes not only that they initiated the relationship, but also that they're the one that sustains that relationship. So Job thinks because he's continued to listen to God's words, he's continued to try to do what God has said to do, even when God has taken away that relationship, Job is the one who's consistent in the relationship. He's the one who's putting in more in the relationship. Now think about yourself in just a human relationship. How many times have you been in a relationship where you go, well, I've done this and this and this, and you start listing, right, all the things you've done in the relationship. I'm the one who always invites. I'm the one who always gives this. I'm the one who thinks about this. What's happening? Ooh, you've just turned self-righteous in your relationship, thinking that what you have given is more important, is more, is greater. Jen, can I share what you talked about, Preston, about in relating?
Sure.
Jen said, so you know that Jen has, Preston is autistic, mm-hmm. And so she says often people will try to relate to Preston, and they'll relate maybe once, maybe twice, but after the second time, they're done, because
initiate anything back.
So they're saying, I'm giving and I'm not getting anything back from there. I'm the one initiating. I'm the one trying to do this. Well, I deserve to have something back, right? In reality, Preston is giving something. It's not the picture of what we want, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening with Job. It's also what's happening with us in our human relationships, right? And I think it's really would behoove us to recognize our human relationships are really just a derivative of our relationship with God. So that we begin to think, if I'm in relationship and I'm thinking I'm the one who's always sustaining this, you have just become self-righteous. You have just gone from your integrity down to self-righteousness because you've begun to think that there's deficits in the other, right? Ashley, you put it really well when I was in there, how Job went from his integrity to self-righteousness, right? That he began to see, well, there's some deficits in God's character here. God's not doing this. And as soon as I say, look at the other in the relationship and say, you're not giving me what I need in the relationship, then I become, I've been giving a lot. I've been doing this. We talked about this is what happens in the brain, right? I'm going to now justify myself. And every time I justify myself, I will always minimize the other's value, what they're giving.
That sounds like my husband and me this morning.
We do it all the time, right? We do it all the time. And whether we do it verbally, and more importantly, we do it in our thinking, right? We think, I've done this 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. Fine, I'm going to show you. And the problem with that is that pride within, pride is always separation, right? So self-righteousness, pride, all the same things, same words that they're using. But pride in relationship is still separation, which sounds weird, right? It sounds like, how can that be if pride is separation? But there's pride within relationship because pride, arrogance, vanity, self-righteousness, it says you are the one that is giving more in the relationship. And because you're the bigger contributor, you actually are afforded privileges within that relationship. Do you get that? So it's not quite a transaction because you're not wanting outside benefits. You want more relationship, but you want it in the way, to fit the way you think relationship is. And so then self-righteousness becomes very slippery, right? When you don't get what you think you should have in a relationship, you become dissatisfied. And when you become dissatisfied, it leads to scoffing. And he will use this vocabulary in there. And scoffing is always the devaluing of another's giving, what somebody else is giving. So if I were to speak with Preston and Preston doesn't speak back to me or shake my hand or whatever, then I scoff. Why isn't he doing that? Why isn't he giving what I think he should give? That's scoffing. And what happens then, scoffing then often leads to your own attempts to get what you want by illegitimate means. So in other words, Job is going to use illegitimate means to get what he wants by demanding that God listen to him and let his case be. Like, you got to come to court, God, because you're not doing it right. So a lot of times we will use the illegitimate mean of demanding. So you're in a relationship, you don't like what you're getting out of that relationship, and so you are dissatisfied, and so you begin to demand, right? How well does that go? It actually makes everything worse, doesn't it? You demand. Because what happens when you demand? Teresa, what did we say about when I'm going to say you've done something wrong? I'm going to get defensive. So demanding, all it can guarantee is you getting walls put up in your face, right? But we feel like we need to take some action because we're not getting what we want in the relationship. That's what Job has done. For us, what are some ways that we do? Besides, we can demand vocally or verbally in relationship, in human relationships. What are other kinds of ways that we use illegitimate means to get out of the relationship what we want?
Manipulate.
How would we do that?
Clam up.
Subtle hints that shame the other person into getting what I want.
Good. Yes. Yep. So we'll use shame a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. I think rules. I'm thinking more not so much like a volunteer relationship. Like, you need to do these kinds of things in order to...
So true. That I go to that a lot. Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. Rules.
Flattery.
What?
Flattery,
yep.
When you clam up. And just
wait
for the situation.
Exactly, yep.
So, guilt.
Yep, guilt, right, exactly, yeah. What about things like I'll go and buy my value somewhere, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'll go shopping. I'll buy stuff. I'll order lots of stuff online because, I'm valuable in this relationship, and they're not showing it, so I'll show. I'm valuable enough to spend the family's money on what I want, right? Something like that. And it can go as far as doing other things, right? That would be even more hurtful to a relationship, right?
Infidelity
whether it be actually all the way to physical infidelity or, right? I'm going to get someone else to talk with me. I'm going to go out with my friends, or I'm going to, you know, somebody else is paying attention to me, so I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. So when we think about self-righteousness, don't think first about, oh, I think I'm better than you. Think about, in a relationship, I think I'm giving more. I think I'm the one sustaining it better. Mm-hmm. And they're not giving what I want out of this relationship. You see the twist in that? Mm-hmm. That makes it a little more poignant to us to come home. Because, again, if I have a list of behaviors that are self-righteous, I can easily check those off and avoid them. Mm-hmm. But it is this thinking that I'm the one that's giving more in a relationship than someone else.
I deserve
because, it can be put in beautiful terms, right? Because I deserve a better relationship than this, right? This is really the answer so many times we give for I want to leave. I deserve a better relationship than this. Mm-hmm. But what a problem is, it's an inward mindset, right? And an inward mindset always gives the opportunity for the other to have an inward mindset. So it's a separating thing. So self-righteousness is always a separating thing. That's what's happening with Job. That's what happens with us. So although Job's motivation is still integral, he still wants relationship. He's lost sight of the kind of relationship that he should be involved in, the kind of relationship that is whole, that is healthy. Self-righteousness will always disparage the other's character and reject what is offered. So, in your relationships with humans, but also in your relationship with God. And I think one of the things for me that I've learned more and more out of Job is the way I relate with others is just indicative of the way I relate with God. Mm-hmm. They are not separate. You can't be, really good with your relationship with God and not really good with your relationship with others. They come from the other. Our relationship with others come from, because that's how we begin to see other people. So how does Job do this? His self-righteousness disparages God's justice, right? Because he assumes he knows what God's doing. God's punished me for no reason, and he's silent, and he's not giving me what I want. He's pulling away from relationship. So what he will do then is he'll take the reins to reestablish relationship by his own means. By vindication, I'm going to get this relationship back. So understand, Job's motivation is still good. He still wants relationship, but he's doing it by illegitimate means. He's trying by illegitimate means to get it back. On top of which, he thinks he's lost it, and he hasn't. He has not lost relationship with God. He just, the way he sees things. He demands that God respond to him. And that's what happens in a relationship. If I begin to see it as proportional and it's not, then I begin to say, well, you've got to respond to me because I've been doing all these things for relationship and you're not responding to me. So you have to respond to me. I think about how many times I've done that and how ridiculous it is. I mean, it's like shaking somebody to say, talk to me the way I want you to. Say, I love you. Say, I love you. I mean, it's ridiculous when we sit back and think about it, and yet in the midst of that, that's what happens, right? We do that all the time. Job says, God, you're not just. You aren't doing relationship right. I'm going to show you how to do relationship right. So that we need to remember. And the minute we do that in a relationship in humanity, step back and go, whoa, am I doing that with God? In some shape, form, or way, I'm doing that with God. So here's where Elihu is wrong. Elihu actually comes to the wrong conclusion. So Elihu is right about God, that he is not inconsistent, that he is just, and he's transcendent, and we can't figure out everything he's doing. But he's wrong about the conclusion. So he believes, why is Job doing this? Because Job wants to regain benefits. And that's a problem because Job never, ever asks for that, right? He thinks that if God doesn't restore his benefits, Job is actually going to be tempted to align himself with evildoers and begin to use illegitimate means to get what he wants, get his benefits back. In reality, Job is still concerned with relationship and only about the restoration of relationship. And yet, he does fall into the trap of using illegitimate means to get what he wants. In the restoration of that relationship, Job is going to need to understand how relationship is ordered. He's also going to need to understand who he's in relationship with. He needs to know God better. So he's in relationship with God, and he knows God to an extent, but not well enough, right? Why being saved isn't the end of our restoration. It is the beginning of our restoring, of God's restoring relationship with him. So we need to make sure that we are careful about our own self-righteousness. We need to, unlike Job, not be so concerned about God responding to us. We need to be more concerned about us responding to God. And this is what, every time we're more concerned about God responding to us, we can be pretty sure that we have fallen into that self-righteousness trap. That we think that we've poured enough into this relationship that we deserve God to respond to us. And yet it is, how many times do we ignore responding to God? Just think about your prayer life. Is it mostly telling God what needs to be done? This person's sick, heal them. This situation is really awful, fix that. You know, it really, I'm getting married on Sunday and it's going to look like rain. It needs to not rain. The interesting thing, Annie actually said that, and she said, but God, I know there's lots of people who need rain. So, you know, whatever it needs to. So.
That's right. It's not between 2 and 4.
Yeah. And sometimes we get that very specific, right? But examine your prayer life. Is it mostly, this is what I need, this is what you need to do? Are you going to respond to me, God? Or is it mostly, God, you have done this for me. Wow. What shall I do for you? Or how can I show you my gratitude? Or what would you like me to do? Asking God, telling him, praising him what he's done for us, saying, God, this is a hard situation. I don't get it. Thank you. I know you're going to be with me. What would you like me to do? How would you show me the good? That kind of thing. So even examining your own prayer life will give you an idea of, are you expecting God to respond to you? Is that the majority of where you're speaking with God? Or are you responding more to God? And when we think about all the things we've learned about God, God is for us. Instead of saying, oh, God is for us, well, then God, why don't you do this for me? Can we look at it? God is for us. How do I respond then? How do I respond to that? Yes. How do I respond to each of the things I'm learning about God? Those are the questions we should be asking.
Do you think God drops ideas into our head, though, to do something specific?
I do.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But that takes practice in listening. Yes.
And then follow up and listening. Do it.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, what it does, what self-righteousness does, it paints an inaccurate picture of God. So, Elihu tells Job that his self-righteousness says that God isn't coming up to his standards, to his Job standards. But the truth is that Job needs to submit to God's wisdom. It's got to be the other way around. Job's demands for vindication, for life to run according to how he thinks life should run, paints an inaccurate picture of God. And so Elihu will give a few examples, because Job, God is not inconsistent or flawed like you say he is. Your actions are telling the world that God is inconsistent. You're presenting a lie. You're slandering God. And slandering is a legal term, right? We can actually bring a lawsuit against somebody who slanders, who says, tells a lie about us. And that's what he says Job is doing. Justice isn't perverted because by Job's circumstances. It's just that Job is interpreting his circumstances wrongly. He's interpreting them by how his picture is, rather than saying, "This is God is just, therefore this must be just." Of course, we know that we're not talking about justice, but Elihu still thinks he is. He says also because God is not contingent. Do you know what the word contingent means? Yeah, God does not rely on you. He doesn't need you. You need him. God is the only self-existent being. He doesn't need us. And Job's arguments presents the opposite, right? That God needs him. That God needs him to tell him, "Oh, God, you're doing it wrong. This is not how we do a relationship." And Elihu is saying, "Oh, Job, who do you think you're talking to?" Job does not need you to tell him what to do. His justice isn't perverted by what you sense as a movement away from you. Just because what you sense perhaps isn't what is actually happening.
What does it mean when you don't give God the glory and it says the rocks will cry out?
Because God will have the truth known, right?
Even though he commands the rocks to cry out, then if we don't, if they didn't back when he was talking about it.
Yeah, and that's
the rocks to cry out.
Yes, that's actually, again, it's a metaphor, but it's saying in the end, God's glory will be known. His truth will be known. Okay. Elihu says, "Job, God has a right to his silence. Who are you to tell him he can't be silent and that that's the wrong way to relate?" Sometimes, sometimes in relationship, you know, lately we've been told in our culture that relationships are all about talking it all out. And, you know, for you extroverts, you think that is absolutely the way it is. But for introverts, give me time, give me space, right? I talk to my daughter-in-law about this a lot. She's an extreme extrovert. My son is an extreme introvert. I said, it isn't always necessary to talk everything out right now. There is a space for silence, right? And that's what Elihu is saying. God knows when silence needs to be happening. Silence doesn't mean he's drawn away from you. Silence doesn't mean that he has left the relationship. And he says again, silence may not actually be silence. You think it's silence because he's not speaking your way, but he's speaking in dreams. He's speaking in pain.
Well, in the example of, what's it called? When someone passes, is it
Shiva?
When you sit?
Shiva.
When somebody mentioned that.
Yep.
Silence is not engaging.
Exactly.
Not loving. It's,
right.
It is. Being with.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Not being words.
And remember, that's always where we're going to get to is God's presence. That space of Sabbath where he can be God, that's where we're going toward, right? That's the goal. So Elihu is trying to give him a little bit of lessons in what God is like. Silence doesn't mean that he has withdrawn. Because also, he says to Elihu, God is not accountable to you. God doesn't answer to the creature. The creature answers to the creator. And again, he uses the word maker. Job is calling for God to account himself to him. But that's just the opposite of what is truth, right? The creator doesn't answer to the creature. God's omniscience and omnipresence allows him to maintain justice without any information from humanity, right? So I love this section where Elihu talks about, do you think God needs to go investigate things? You think he needs to go interview people and say, well, how can I come up with a judgment here? He doesn't need to do this. He already knows all that. He's everywhere. He knows all things. He can just pronounce a judgment. He doesn't need to go through all that trial thing. And yet you want to bring God to trial. He's trying to get Job to understand who God is so that Job will understand his actions are not beneficial. Whereas the friends did not try to get him to understand who God is. They just tried to get him to change his behavior, which is pretty much how we like to do things, right? Just change your behavior. You shouldn't do that. This here's a bad behavior. You shouldn't do this. Instead of going, this is who God is. Now, how do we respond to God? That's a very different way of looking about discipling one another. And lastly, God is committed to caring for humanity with grace. And this is interesting that in here, Elihu is the first one to actually bring up God's grace. And I think this, again, was noticed, was talked about in your groups. God warns, he says, once and twice. He doesn't just warn and that's it. He gives them a couple chances. He gives humanity a couple chances. He tries to keep man from the pit. Like, you're going down this way. Don't go that way. He helps them to turn around and pay attention to him. Job thinks the warnings are merely punishment. And Elihu says, no, no, no. They're grace. They're grace. They're grace. So Elihu brings up the idea that God is this great and powerful, wise being, but also a being of grace, that he wants to bring you back from not paying attention. So here's where Elihu goes off target a little. He thinks that self-righteousness is a possible theodicy. Do you remember what theodicy is? It's an explanation for suffering. Why is there evil in the world? That's what theodicy is. And Elihu is the only one who actually proposes a theodicy, which is really, Job wants to know, why am I suffering? And no one's really answered that. And Elihu will say, friends, you haven't even answered his question. I'm going to answer his question. And he says, this is his thought process. This is an interesting thought process. Remember that God has defended, or that Elihu has defended God's justice by saying he is great. He is transcendent. So we have to talk about the word transcendent. We'll talk about it a little more in a minute. That he's beyond you. So you can't understand his justice, so you can't question whether the justice is working or not, whether the RP is working or not. His transcendence makes him incomprehensible, so you can't begin to question his justice. So, Job, I know God is just, and I don't know how it all works, but your suffering has to have been deserved. This is Elihu's thinking, and I'm telling you already, it's wrong thinking. So Job just can't comprehend how God's working his justice in his life. So Elihu is defending the RP. This is how he defends it. This is a really interesting way to defend it, because I think this is hard for you to pull this out a little bit. He says Job's offense is not something he did before the suffering. So Job was upright before the suffering. But he suffered, and in his suffering, something got uncovered in Job. A response to suffering got uncovered, right? Because how is Job's response to suffering been? At first it was great, right? I'll still praise God. But it's deteriorated, right, into now self-righteousness. And so he says the cause of Job's suffering was a future or potential sin in Job. And that's what brought about the suffering. Now, I think that's a really interesting possibility. The problem with it is, it's not what God says about Job. He says right from the very beginning, Job is upright and blameless, and he doesn't deserve any of the suffering that's going to happen to him. He tells us that right from the beginning. So we know that even Elihu's really well-worked-out theodicy is incomplete. It's wrong. Human attempts at theodicy are always presumptuous because God has not told us all of the reasons for suffering. Now, there are times we know the reason for suffering, but those times we don't actually question it, right? I ran into the street and got hit by a car. Why did I get hit by a car? Because I ran in the street. I don't say, God, why did you bring that car and hit me right there? Well, I already knew that if I ran in the busy street, I was going to get hit. It's those times when suffering comes and it feels like it's out of nowhere. For Job, for many of us, right? Things just happened. This week for me has been one of those. Wow, my brother-in-law was put on life support. Now he has been sick, but didn't expect that out of the blue. And do we say, oh, well, he was put on life support because you didn't do this or you? No, we have no idea, and God isn't going to tell us why. So Elihu, although I really like Elihu's idea, it's not the reason for suffering. It actually might be the purpose, but not the reason. So we have to be careful about that. So he basically says, look, the RP is standing, but the RP is actually an educative theodicy. So it's there not just as punitive, but it's also there for teaching. It's there to teach you where not to go or where you could go, where your possibilities are. The problem is we all have those proclivities towards sin. And so that if that were true, if that's how the RP worked, that means that we would all be suffering all the time, right? Because we all need to have that coming out. So it might be God's purpose, but it's not the reason for suffering. So here's Elihu's advice to Job and to the self-righteous. Take God's transcendence seriously. And although Elihu's theodicy is not right, he does give an accurate picture of God's character. And because of that, we also need to take his advice to Job to heart for ourselves as well. So he says there's two ways to approach God. The first is you can pray for relief from oppression. But the words he uses here, the vocabulary, say, this kind of prayer for relief is really just about you, right? I just don't want to suffer anymore. And it's not about, oh, God, help me think better of you. Help me think more rightly about you. Help me see if there's any way in me that is not pleasing to you. No, it's just get me out of this suffering. I don't like this suffering. So he says God's not going to respond to that. That's an empty prayer. That's a vain prayer. That's a prayer all about you and not about putting your attention on God. So that's not the way to approach God. He says the second way, and this is the way he recommends, is to search for God. Pay attention to God. Look for where God is and recognize his grace as he teaches you wisdom, however that is. Basically, what Elihu is saying is you should be more interested in coming to know God better than trying to get God to solve your problems. Now remember also that this book is a precursor to Psalms, because Psalms says we can go to God and say, we're hurt, we're angry, but you need to know this first, right? That you should be more interested in coming to know God better than to trying to get God to solve your problems. That's not paying attention to God, is it, right? What are you paying attention to?
Yourself.
God should be the object of your inquiry and your search, not the object of complaining. So I want to know you better. How can I know you better here? Rather than, I really don't like this, God. This is stupid. You need to change it. In other words, you can't treat God like a dog and make him heal, right? Right now, God, do this now. Nope, come with me now. Stop. Don't do that. Think about how I always find it really funny to walk the neighborhood and see how human beings are talking to their dogs. Very interesting. But unfortunately, it does seem to really encapsulate some of the ways we think about God, thinking that way. He says, Job, you need to approach God with an open mindset, with an outward mindset, rather than an inward mindset. Recognize your own place. Do you know who you're in a relationship with? Although he's beyond you, he condescends to be in relationship with you. So when you think you're the one sustaining the relationship, when you think you're the one giving the most, you got to think about this. He is other. When we talk about transcendence, transcendence means he's not. How would you define transcendence?
Breaking all boundaries.
Across all.
Breaking all boundaries, I think, is really good. He's outside of who we are. He's other. Unfortunately, we tend to think about God as being the greatest being. And that is inaccurate. That is actually a heresy, to think he's the greatest of beings. He's outside of our beings. Remember I talked about how important theology is and how we just don't talk about that. They just did a Pew Research thing on how well the church knows their theology. It was horrible. Horrible. And the worst heresy that most Christians believe is that Jesus was the greatest creation that God made. Like 74%. That's what he's talking about here. Do not think of God as just the greatest human being. Do not think of God as the greatest. No, God is other. He's not in this realm of humanity that we're thinking about. He's not like us. He's other than us. He's beyond time. He's the standard for life. He's the standard for wisdom. He's the standard for holiness. He's outside of that, of all the things that we are. So recognize who you're in relationship with. And the fact that he condescends to come and be in relationship with you, that should be a response of awe, not a response of, oh, great, you're here. Here's what you can do. We need to show more recognition of our own place. That's why Elihu uses the word maker so often in here. When I use the word maker, I recognize he is my creator and I am the creature. While no relationships are proportional, no healthy relationships are proportional. I remember going to a wedding where the pastor said, so you have to remember that you're going to give 50% and you're going to give 50%.
No.
Absolutely not. And every one of you that's married knows not the case, right? Not the case. Relationships are not meant to be proportional. But in humanity, they're not proportional. From between humanity and God, they are the most disproportionate relationship there is. Absolutely disproportionate. We are only connected by grace, not by equality. So we need to think about in terms of responding to God rather than getting God to respond to us. God responds to his own purposes and timing.
Repeat what you said about grace again, please.
We are connected only by grace and not by equality.
I wish we had different words for God. Right, I know the Bible does, but like when we say he, she,
yes.
In some Jewish faiths, they don't even spell out.
Correct.
They go G
and that's why.
And that.
Now does that make sense?
Message.
Yes, yeah. It gives a believe to him as he is so beyond us that we can't even speak his name, mm-hmm. And that G-D is Yahweh. That's how it's pronounced, Yahweh. But if you're Orthodox Jew, you've never heard that pronounced ever, because he's so beyond us. And it's something that we have lost, I think, in evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. We've lost this idea of God being so much more than us.
He's our friend.
Yes, and we talk a lot about him being our friend. And although Jesus says, you are my friends, there is this idea of, it's like you being friends with Queen Elizabeth.
Right.
Like, well, yeah, but who deigned to be the friend? Who was the one who said, I'm going to choose you to be a friend, and I will allow you to be in part of my life, but you have no idea what my life is about. Right? There's so much more.
Do you think that's come because we've made it so personal?
Yes.
And so we take it as a selfish thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking also, we talked about this in our group, that because we are made in God's image, we have reversed that to
correct.
God's and mm-hmm. our
mm-hmm. That's correct. Image. Yes. Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very much so.
Driving over here, God is not he or she. God is
that's cool. I do think that's important for us to grapple with the idea of God being beyond us. Mm-hmm. And it is only with that understanding do we then have any inkling of his imminence, of his closeness, of his being with us in relationship. And that's what Job is missing, right? And that's what Elihu is trying to get him to see. Do you realize who you're in relationship with? Who you're talking to? You can't talk to God that way because he is other. He is not an equal here. Understand God's transcendence through his mighty acts. And so Elihu then goes through this idea of God is maker. And God is not just maker. And that he's not going to, in his making, he has said, I'm going to treat humanity with grace. Not only is he that, but his activity is beyond understanding. And so Eliyahu goes into this long, beautiful hymn about rain and thunder and lightning and storm. So I have lots of notes here, and I'm not going to go through it. It's this understanding of, remember, A&E doesn't think materialistically. So we look at that and go, oh, it sounds like he's describing the water cycle. Yeah, no, because they're not concerned about the mechanisms of nature. They're concerned, when they wanted to control the weather, it was a theological issue, because it's really about who controls the weather. When we want to do it, we want to know the mechanics, right? And so we try to manipulate the weather by learning the mechanics. There's still lots and lots of research out there. How can we seed clouds so that it rains when we want it? Mm-hmm. And we still haven't figured that out. Mm-hmm. And we've said, well, at least we can predict what's going on. But we've always separated it from who controls it. It's really a theological issue. And it's not ours to control. So that's kind of what's going on in here, is getting Job to understand how complex God's workings of the worlds are, and that everything he does, he makes sure that it all works together to bring his purpose about. And the interesting thing is that when he does that, when God does that, when he brings all these, this is why I asked you the question, what was the biggest event that you ever organized? Lots of you said weddings. What were some of the other things?
Family reunion,
fundraisers, things like that. All of those, where was the most difficult thing in doing those things? Was it doing the list? Oh, I need to get the flowers. I need to get this, this, and this.
Working with the people.
Why? Why is that the most complicated issue?
They change their minds.
Right, because they have the freedom to choose, mm-hmm. Right? Think about that. That everything God does is not just, I've organized the world this way, but I've also given humanity freedom to choose. And every choice that a human makes, God is going to work that into the weave of his purpose getting done. Now, I wanted to show a clip from Bruce Almighty. Did you ever watch that show? Ever see that show? Where God says, oh, you think you can do better than me? It's basically part of Job. You think you can do better than me? All right, you be God for a day. And he tries, right? And he finds out, oh, it's a lot more complicated. I wanted to show you the clip of the prayers. He said, how am I going to deal with prayers? There's a million prayers coming in. Oh, prayers coming in, prayers coming in. And first he thinks, filing cabinets. So he tries to put them in all the filing cabinets. That doesn't work. Sticky notes, he tries to do that. Computer, we can put them on computer. And then he realizes every time he answers one, there's a million or 3 million more. And then he finally decides, here's the easy way. He says, to all, yes. Which you go, oh, that's hilarious. So think about that. What happens? Now you have to think about all the fallout for that. All of that to say. And that's really just an idea of to say, what God is doing is ridiculously complex. And for you to think that you know what's going on, and then for you to tell God, hey, God, you got to do it a different way, is ridiculous. It also reminds us that our inward mindset doesn't give God that space, right, of where is God working. So I'll just give you one example of this extreme weather idea. So he talked about how extreme weather can bring his judgment, right? Snow will stop the crops, ice will halt everything. A lot of times you'll hear preachers say that extreme weather brought, you know, this devastation because God is judging. And the truth is, sometimes it could be that. We know God could do that. The problem is we can't decide that. But here's how to look at it in a different way. So in Thailand, there were these group of Christians who actually lived on the coast. And the majority people were not Christians, and they began to persecute them terribly. They began to oppress these small groups of Christians. So much so that they kept making sure they couldn't live in their homes. And eventually they pushed these Thailanders into the inners of the country. And so they no longer could live there. They were so oppressed by these people. So for years. And they tortured them. They did horrible things for them. So the Christian Thailanders were living inside the country. And then these the oppressors were all living on the coast. And then came the tsunami of Christmas. what year was that? 2002, that's what I was thinking. 2002, the tsunami. Everyone knows what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. The tsunami, it devastates everyone that's living on the coast. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the first response of the Church of Christians are, oh, God used it to punish mm-hmm. the wicked who have oppressed us. Mm-hmm. That was their first response. And then the second response, and the pastor said, maybe it's not that. Maybe it's God has just given us an opportunity to go minister mm-hmm. to our oppressors. Mm-hmm. That's the change from an inward mindset to an outward mindset. I don't know what God's doing, but is he giving me this raw place so that I can actually let his life flow in me and I can actually minister to others mm-hmm. with that? Do you see the difference there? Mm-hmm. I can't decide what God's doing. I can't decide how he's working the world. But I can allow the raw spaces that it makes in my life to let his life flow through me. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between an inward mindset and an outward mindset, which is really where Elihu is going with Job. Is Job, you've got to change your ideas of what God is doing. You can't figure out what God's doing, but what God is doing is something good. I'm trying to skip through a couple things here, because I think it's important for us to discern what is application for us. Elihu gives a really good defense of God's character, and he does a good job of telling us what God is like. So I think we're compelled to take his advice. But his conclusion about God's policies, how God runs the world, is not consistent with what God said. So we need to take that out. God doesn't use the RP as a way to punish future, or at least we don't know. We have no idea. But here are the things that I think we need to take from Elihu's speeches. Number one, we need to check against self-righteousness in ourselves. When I begin to find deficiencies in God's character, how could a loving God do that? How could you possibly do that to me, God? You set yourself on a slope that's going to go towards self-righteousness. And in self-righteousness, I assume I'm the center of the relationship. I think that God needs me. I think that God is accountable to me. And self-righteousness will always blind you to the transcendence of God, because it pits your righteousness on an even field with God's righteousness. And I think when we check against self-righteousness, if we're having a hard time figuring out, am I self-righteous when I'm talking about my relationship with God? Then just examine your human relationships. Mm-hmm. Am I self-righteous there? Am I catching myself thinking? And my guess is most of us don't say it. But am I catching myself thinking, you know, I put an awful lot into this relationship. I cook your meal every day. So I expect something back, right? Am I ever thinking that way? That should remind you, oh, I have said that relationship is proportional. That if I put this in, you've got to give me this much. Relationships aren't proportional. No relationships are proportional. Relationships are always an opportunity for you to pour yourself out, and always an opportunity to receive from the other what the other can give. Self-righteousness is going to blind you to the transcendence of God. It's also going to blind you to what others are giving you, right? Secondly, commit to appreciating God's transcendence. God is greater than man. There's really no good metaphor to span the difference between God and man. A lot of times people will use, it's like an ant to a human. Right. And that gives us some idea, but it's not even close. So we need to begin to appreciate God's transcendence, his otherness, that he's in a class by himself, that he's the standard for what life is. And we must grapple with his transcendence before we can understand and appreciate his immanence, his grace. Grace doesn't mean much if I don't understand how much he's giving and how much he's given up. to condescend. In theology, they use the word condescend a lot with God, that God condescends. And we have a very negative connotation of that. We should reimagine that idea of him condescending to us, to be in relationship with us, as this this huge idea of grace. The only way we can even begin to grapple the transcendence is to recognize that we cannot understand, to know what I don't know, to understand that I can't understand, and that in my not understanding, God pours out grace. He tells Isaiah, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. A proper relationship with God in his transcendence is to understand that the relationship is one of disproportion. We can't possibly cover that gap. Thirdly, be content with mystery. Transcendence always speaks of mystery. God neither micromanages nor is uninvolved. It's a mystery of how he's involved. We can't easily define how God works. Sometimes God will use pain. Sometimes he'll use suffering to get our attention. Sometimes he'll use dreams, nightmares. Sometimes he'll use weather. And sometimes those things are for a different reason, and we don't know. But if our attention is on God rather than on our circumstances, and I know that can be a very trite thing to say. When you're in the midst of hard circumstances, how do you get there? This is why Job is so foundational. Get there before you're in those circumstances, that your attention can be easily brought back to who God is. We need to learn to respond to God rather than looking for him to respond to us. So that when we go through all of those pieces that we've learned, God is for us, God wants us to examine our thoughts, God cannot be defined by systems, God can't be evaluated by pictures, God's power is purposefully directed, God knows what he's doing, then how do I respond to those? Those things should be set up in my mind to think through. God, how can I respond to the truth that you know what you're doing in this hard situation? How can I respond to that? And a lot of times the response is silence. The response is waiting. The response is trusting, right? Trusting always talks about hope and waiting. And waiting for him to reveal himself. And one thing that Elihu brought up, and that we'll see a little bit more, is the idea of praise. To be able to say, God knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. God knows what he's doing. And he's able to actually bring everything together to work for his purpose. And that is to make a space where he can be God and we can be his people. Any questions? Yes. Lord Jean, waiting.
I was like, yes, I do. This idea of mystery.
Yes.
He invites us into this relationship, this paracratic dance. Like, I feel like it's not all mystery.
It's not all mystery. Nope.
He reveals.
Yep.
He aggressively reveals. And he wants us to be co-creators. And
yep.
Work with me.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
But being okay with, there are times where I'm not.
Right.
And I will trust.
Yes.
Because, I mean, the relationship is just, like, he's 100%.
Right. Right, exactly.
I'm only connected by grace, thank you.
Exactly. I mean, it's like, so if you are a friend of Queen Elizabeth, and, like, you know that she's queen and you know she runs the country, but do you have any idea of how that works? And is that necessary for you to know all the things? You know some things, right? You know, she attends all these, you know, fundraisers, you know, that she appoints the next king, whatever. You know some things, but there's some things that are just mysterious to you, right? Some things that you don't even get, like, even though you know one of the things about, it used to be about queens and kings, you couldn't be the first one to speak, right? The queen had to speak to you so that you could. And to an American, that is like a mystery. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that a good thing? But I actually think that's a beautiful picture, right? That's actually what God tells us. What are Psalms? Psalms tell us how to speak to God, but how to respond to God. not how to bring it up first, not to initiate, but to answer, right? So mystery, along with the fact that he reveals so much of himself, is huge, right? It's huge. And that he brings that transcendence then down into immanence. Here's the interesting thing. If you study other religions, they will talk about transcendence. They get transcendence. What they don't get is transcendence with immanence. So no other religion brings, except for Judeo-Christian, no other religion brings together transcendence and immanence together in that piece. So all others are transcendence. So it's an interesting mix that he's asking us to receive. Can you receive that I am both so beyond you and so far from you, and that I am so close to you? Yes.
We are fully human.
Yes.
But we also can go to the Father.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So really, when we talk about mystery, we talk a lot about paradox, right? Mm-hmm. We don't understand paradox, mm-hmm. but we're asked to receive that. Mm-hmm. And Job is such a foundation of receiving paradox, so that when we get to the New Testament, we've got all these paradoxes that we're to receive, and now we have a foundation for it. Any other questions? Let's end with our verse and our prayer. Job 42:2. I know that you can do all things, and no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Let's pray. Almighty God.
To you all hearts are open, all desires known, and from you no secrets are hid. Cleanse the thoughts of our hearts by the inspiration of your Holy Spirit, that we may perfectly love you and worthily magnify your holy name. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.